Hello, I'm Scott. You're listening to The Joys of Teaching Literature. We're talking about all things high school English and how to make life easier, how to make life enjoyable, less stressful. I've been thinking about that a lot this year. It's a question every year, I guess, is how to make less stressful. But I think this year, there's just a lot going on. We're still wearing masks, although a lot of states are taking their masks off. I just think it's a year that we're transitioning off of a lot of remote learning. Kids are just sort of fell into some bad habits last year, so getting them going, get the car on the highway is not that easy this year. So that's kind of what we're generally talking about, but I think especially now is just making life, however we can do it, a little bit easier. And today it's I'm describing like a kind of system that I teach, and it's called Whole Novel Activities. If you want to know more about me, my website's theteachersworkshop.com, and I offer online professional development for high school English teachers. And actually, you know, while we're on this topic of whole novel activities, all of my whole novel activities, which I'll describe in a second, are all online on my Teachers Pay Teachers store. So you can get a little sample of sort of what goes on in my classroom and see examples of student work and see how it lends itself to being flexible, to differentiation, to a lot of different things. It just makes my life easy. I think in terms of topics. And so that's kind of what we're talking about today, is sort of topic-based learning, if you want to call it. I think, if we think about it in a way, you know, what we're doing with novels is really, really difficult, right? First of all, are dealing with students who watch Netflix, they go on TikTok, they go on Snapchat, right? All these apps that are designed to keep somebody's attention for literally a couple of seconds. TV works that way too. A shot in a movie or television show lasts about 5 seconds or maybe even less. The cartoons my daughter watches, you just get one image. It's just images flashing at you all the time. And those images are spectacular images. There's a lot of different things going on in a single frame on a television show. There's music going on. There's people talking to each other. You're changing the angle of, you know, how you're looking at the scene unfold. It's very entertaining. And social media is that way too. When you're flipping through online, you get this super, super entertaining thing. You get the thing that everyone else on the planet also thinks is super entertaining, and that's getting to the top of the algorithm or the feed that you're looking at. They're catering it to your interests, so anything that you're interested in, they're giving you that. There's a ton of engineering behind media, and we're like, hey, I have this 220 page novel I was looking at today. How many pages are in Beloved? To the Lighthouse is 209 pages, I think. Emma by Jane Austen is over 400 pages. So hey, let's go into this other world that you're not familiar with, 1814 in the case of Jane Austen, right? And just try to appreciate the language of that time, some of the social issues, the etiquette, the social norms, the conventions, the manner of speaking, that whatever social class that you're in and exploring, and just read for long periods of time. And it's a skill that we want. I think about the world that we live in right now, where people consume their news, not just their, what's going on with their friends or something, text messaging, and it's images everywhere. But it's the news, right? We want students and everyone who graduates high school to go off into the world enthusiastic about reading entire books. Books are still the foundation of our knowledge, as far as our understanding of the world is concerned. Not just, hey, here's this one headline of today, but here are these historical patterns, right? These in social sciences, you're looking at all these experiments and people trying to crunch numbers and run different experiments where we learn about human behavior. So there's just a lot of information that scientists are uncovering about the world that we live in, psychology, neuroscience, global warming, you know, war, taxes, you know, the economy. There's just so many things about the world that we live in that we want our students to be curious and be interested in. Of course, different historical time periods. We want them to know all the statistics and different facts about this war happened then and this is what led to this. But we also want them to know about what life was like back then and how it's sort of similar, has similarities between the life that we live now. And stories are there entertaining. And when we use our imagination to sort of visualize or feel what's going on with another character, and when we track topics and ideas, those ideas intersect with the ideas that we have about the world that we live in. And we want them to be able to read a text that is long and complicated and has a lot of different moving parts and has flashbacks. And I'm going to tell you this story about what happened to me 10 years ago, and it's going to be 5 pages long. Or I'm going to walk through the woods for 7 or 8 or 9 pages in Jane Eyre. And that's going to really make you feel what it's like to be lost and without a home and without parents, right? With no one in the world. I need you to read these 10 pages. And I know it feels boring, and I know it feels like, why am I continuing to, you know, get these descriptions of woods? I get it. It's the forest, right? But it's got a purpose and a value to really understand, you know, the middle of the 19th century, what it was like to be a female and to be an orphan. And so I can go on and on about the value of novels, but that's the end point here, is that we want our students to be able to be comfortable reading a novel, not by having us spoon feed answers to them, where they just go through and read this chapter by this knight, and let's talk about the plot, and let's talk about what happened before, and then we sort as we go, we build on meaning, and we start to develop, you know, this conversation about topics and themes. But we want them to. I want to have a student that can read an entire novel without me even talking about the plot or raising questions about the plot until the very end. Because the very end, well, if you read it to the very end by yourself, without any conversation, without your teacher telling you anything, without your classmates saying anything, they're all bringing their interpretation into the story. And I'm thinking particularly of Beloved. Beloved is a, I would say, a good book where you could argue you really got to go through that book chapter by chapter because it is really complicated. The plot has a lot of flashbacks and different little pieces of this puzzle that you're trying to put together. It's complicated, and I can see somebody saying, well, you really need to go through that and walk them through that. But I can also see the point of that book being that you get lost, like history is this thing that you got to kind of get lost in it a little bit. You have to do some mental work to kind of figure out what happened and how it happened and who said this and, oh, this happened and I don't remember that. And why don't I remember that? Why doesn't this person remember that? And, oh, well, because they were over here and they weren't at the location where this was happening, right? So you're trying to piece together who everyone is, how they know each other. And that's what it was like to go through, to live through the time period that Toni Morrison was writing about in Beloved after the Civil War. People were just lost and trying to talk about Jane Eyre. I mean, people were just lost and trying to figure out like what life was going to look like. And Faulkner did this too, right? When Faulkner wrote his novels, a part of there's I tell my students this, right? We used to do The Unvanquished. I said, look, listen, you're gonna read this by yourself. Realize that the moments that you're confused, where you don't know what's going on, that's about memory. It's about how flawed memory can be. There's a beauty to that. There's a beauty of not really knowing what happened to yourself and sort of exploring, well, if I don't know what happened to myself and I don't know exactly what I was thinking because there's so many different things. That was another book about the Civil War and Reconstruction, right? How are we going to reconstruct or reimagine or come to have a deeper sense of what happened? We're gonna basically acknowledge that there are these sort of gaps, and because there was just a lot going on and there was a lot of different things to consider about that time period. And so part of piecing it all together is what we're doing as a kind of, we'll call it like fictional historian, where you're sort of looking at this time period and really understanding not only what happened, but also how it relates to the world that we live in today and how we sort of, you know, play with our memory. So anyway, you know, I think that my point is that we want students, again, thinking about the kids who are graduating. I guess I think about this because I teach seniors. When we think about the kids that are graduating, going off into the world, we want them to read a book by themselves, right? A novel by themselves, because they're curious about the world and how it works, and they want to go to, again, to these different time periods and have stories that, you know, and if they're going to be a storyteller themselves and they're going to, you know, create the next great Netflix series or something, we want them to have that foundational storytelling ability that is done mostly through the greats, through the classics, the great writers and the classics, and these books that are considered the best novels of all time for a reason, because they're full of poetry and they're filled with these structure. There's structure to it. There's multiple ideas running through the whole thing, and what we're trying to do as readers is piece together those ideas and see where those ideas intersect. And some of the best passages, talk about novels, but the best passages in novels, the most famous passages, like we were just going over a passage into the lighthouse and the time passes section of the book, and there's a description of how they're cleaning up this house. And the family is no longer there. So that's complicated to think about. The main family, the Ramseys, are not at the house because the First World War is going on and everybody's not there. They're not there to vacation. People are dying. People are fighting in the war. People are traveling, doing different things. They're not together as a family physically. But the narrative voice stays at the house. And so the question of the spiritual quality of the voice in that middle section of the book comes together when these two housekeepers clean the house up. And as they clean the house up, you're thinking about grieving and loss and closure and as a country, sort of getting yourself back on your feet. All these questions of the Civil War. How are we going to sort of recollect ourselves and be one and be united as a nation after this thing almost tore us apart? That was a question of the First World War as much as it was a question of with the Civil War. How's Europe going to, like, be, you know, a continent after something this horrific and this thing that sort of broke everybody apart? Just got worse when we went into the Second World War. We haven't sort of erased some of the things that happened, you know, some of the divisions that existed before and during and after the Civil War in our country. So what Wolf was doing was saying, okay, so like this happened, it happened. How are we going to sort of reconnect with each other, reconnect with people who are strangers that we're being told by the media and by the press and journalists that we have nothing in common with, that everything that we think, somebody thinks the opposite of that. There's no middle ground. There's no compromises. There's no ways of getting along and understanding each other's points of view. And I'm not saying that there's not differences between people, but what Wolf was after was, we think that we have no ability to get along in the case of the book, you know, family members that, you know, in the case of the father, Mr. Ramsey, so mistreated his kids for so many years, and then Mrs. Ramsey's not there, and so he's got to kind of try to figure out how to be the rock of the family like his wife was, and it's difficult. And so the cleaning of the house sort of represents how difficult it is. Like if you left a house with no one in it for 10 years and you had to go clean it up, symbolically that's super powerful, right? Like you got to clean yourself, your soul up, to get people back together and to heal some of the wounds that were created by the war and by, you know, just regular living, right? We're always hurting people accidentally and nobody's perfect. So we're always looking for forgiveness and we're looking to, you know, move past some of the mistakes that we made in the past, all these different things. And so this one passage, like we've got issues of time, we have issues of memory, identity, the family, gender even, because there's two housekeepers, you know, these two people taking care of the house. All of the issues that we talk about in the novel come together in this one passage, right? And so when I teach a novel, you know, it's about keeping track of those patterns and keeping them very separate. Because when I ask my students to sit down and write an essay, I'm asking them to track patterns. You're gonna have a topic sentence with a topic in it, right? An argument about a topic, and that is gonna be the sort of heart and soul of that paragraph. You have the thesis statement, right? So there's these different structural elements. We can't just say, "Hey, go do this," and when they don't do it, get frustrated because we haven't really shown them how to do it by the way that we cover the novel. We're covering it chapter by chapter. And of course, we can say, like, here's a theme, but when it's fragmented and kind of random, where those themes pop up, it makes a little bit more sense to cover a novel, not chapter by chapter, and this is where I'm going with all this, it's a really long introduction, but by topic by topic. And so I actually don't walk them through chapter by chapter at all anymore. I used to do it earlier in my career. There's a lot of frustrations there. I was mostly guided by PowerPoints and slides. I couldn't talk about the end of the book, which drove me crazy, right? Because when you have a character, you have, okay, this happened to Holden, that, you know, we know that he tries to make amends with his sister, Phoebe, all those different situations that he went through, any character goes through, are important when you look, even if something early on, when they're doing something, you can consider those behaviors later in the book when you're interpreting that moment, because you're saying, okay, in this moment, this is what's going on, but later he does this, and so you can compare all of the things that character has done or said or had happened to them, and look at the big picture all of the time during the whole conversation, not just, because toward the end of your discussion of the book, because you've finally covered all the chapters, but you can talk about character development and thematic development at any time. So the fact that I couldn't mention, like, as a spoiler alert, the end of the book, I just constantly wanted to keep talking about these different things that happened, but I couldn't do that if I was just, doing 10 chapters a week or whatever it was. Also for context, if you look like the passage I just described, it's important to know that Lily, for example, she's painting this painting at the end of the book, and that construction of the painting, that creation of the painting, is parallel to the cleaning up of the house. And so I can't even talk, if we just did by chapter, I wouldn't be able to talk about the painting. Once we got to the painting, I could then go back and say, hey, remember the house? And there's value in that, but we're doing that with every single conversation. We're taking one single passage and just matching it up and connecting it to all these different parts in the book. So that was one reason I sort of transitioned to this new approach. There's what I'm calling the whole novel sort of approach. All of the discussions I also found were focusing on plot. What happens then? Okay, and then what happens? And it wasn't guided by ideas and also by the development of a character. The other thing that's stressful is, how do you check for reading? If you're like, okay, we're going to discuss after chapter 10, at this point, you're doing these weekly reading checks, or are you doing them every 2 weeks? And then they don't read because there's no reading check, or they're procrastinating, right? They're going to read it by that date that you assign. So you can't talk about it until it's due. And for me, it was very, very stressful keeping track of the due dates. Grading all those quizzes, they don't learn when they're taking a quiz. They're not learning anything when they take a quiz. I'm thinking about this with my daughter as I'm trying to teach her how to read right now, and she just needs to learn, like, to see it, like in math too. It's like they have to see it happen first, and then we can assess. We can't just assess all the time. There's no learning happening when we assess. There's obviously value to assessment, right? But when we're doing it all the time just to see if they read. So what I started to do is to assign notes, which is a whole other topic. Like, what do I mean by notes? But that's another topic for another day. But that's basically what I say. And I it's interesting because just today I said, I'm going to collect 3 pages of notes on Beloved. Now, that's a pretty packed 3 pages because they're taking notes about every 5 pages or so. So you're getting a really meaty kind of 3 pages, but that's a minimum. A lot of my kids do way over 3 pages because they enjoy taking notes. And they don't have to take notes as they read. They just take notes, say, after a chapter. They can take notes after they read the entire novel. Some do post-it notes. But it helps me understand that they read the book way more than a quiz does, where they're just like grabbing some summary online and, getting some details. Or I can't tell who's reading the book and who's not. But notes have value because you can use them to help you write the essay. It's just you're gathering evidence as you read, and so that's a valuable thing to have when you go to sit. And that's we want them to do everything in the class to have value. There should be nothing that we do that is a waste of time. And again, like we have so much to do: lesson planning, grading essays, returning essays, conferencing when we return essays, answering emails, meetings. I mean, the list goes on and on. To do something, to take time doing something that doesn't have value, to me doesn't work. So that's another sort of advantage of doing things this way. And I only have one due date. When I plug in due dates online or on the board in class, I just have one date, and they have to keep track of that for 4, 5, 6 weeks, and that's all they have to think about. And every day I just remind them, read this novel, and that way they set their own reading schedule as well. They don't have to get caught because they had a lab due and a soccer game and they didn't have any time to read. They can really plan their own time, and reading becomes this enjoyable thing and not this stressful thing. We're like, oh my God, I got to read up to chapter 10 tonight, right? They can just fit in their reading where it's appropriate. They can read on the weekend and do 2 or 3 hours, as I say, on a Sunday morning when nobody's really doing anything or something like that. They can pick and choose when they read. And so that's a really good, it's a less stressful experience for them. It's less stressful for me. And it just makes the whole thing easier. You're always going to have kids who decide not to read. But you want to make it as easy as possible to jump in and read. You don't want to make it like, all these due dates to keep track of. And, if they don't hit one of those due dates, all of a sudden they haven't read, right, 3 or 4 chapters. And they're like, oh, man, now I got to like read twice as much as I'm supposed to, and I gotta, I'm gonna be really stressed out. So this way, it's just, hey, take your time. You got 5 or 6 weeks. Maybe you read 20 minutes a night, but like I said, maybe you read a chunk on the weekend, because that's, you just find the time when you're free and you're bored, and you go read. And it's better to read in one sitting, I think. I always read books in a couple of sittings because I want to keep track of the top. I easily forget the ideas, the events. I'm just somebody who can't, like, when I read every night, I'm like, oh, wait, what did I read last night? But if I read in one sitting, it all seems cohesive. It seems like with this one story that I'm reading, as opposed to these like mini short stories that I'm reading every night, it's really stressful for me to read every night. And so think about that. How many kids have that same preference where they just don't want to read, in short chunks like that. What this lends itself to is when I introduce a topic, every topic will have a question, first of all, and that question should be a kind of essential question that's meaningful beyond just the text that you're studying. And so I can mention events in the news, I can talk about some music or movie that I saw, or some story from my life. Sometimes I'll start class with a story from my life, like, hey, this is, the topic of memory or love or immersion or whatever it might be. And I, of course, introduce the idea, like, this is what we're looking for in this passage. There's some of the passages are going to be about this, some of the passages are going to be about that. So you sort of guide them as far as what they're going to be looking for when they gather evidence. But it allows there to be a little bit of structure to class too. We always start with a question that guides us through this couple days. Usually it's a couple of days. Sometimes it's a week. Sometimes it's a day. But I'm also, again, modeling what an essay should look like by organizing class by topics and not just by chapters. The structure of a unit functions as a kind of model for the organization of an essay. Before they write, they are prepared to weave the web of their ideas in words. And then they have guided notes that they complete in class to help, that also should help them write the essay. On top of their reading notes, they have class notes. And by the end of a unit, it's different for every unit, but around 50, they've interpreted 50 quotes. They have notes on 50 quotes from the book. So when they go to write the essay, their essay writes itself. There's no stress. There's no, what am I going to write about? Or my gosh, this is a hard prompt. They have all of this evidence, right? And it's organized by topic on top of that. So it the work, they've already done the work, and that's what we want to teach them. If you pay attention in class, if you take notes while you read, the essay should be easy. If you do the work, beforehand, well, if you sit down and you haven't thought about what you're going to write about, yeah, it's going to take forever. It's going to be very, very stressful because you're going to have no idea what you're talking about, and you're going to try to just make stuff up. So here's one example, to the Lighthouse, by Virginia Woolf. It's what we're sort of wrapping it up now. I got about a week left of it with it. The first topic is point of view. So we talk about free and direct discourse and how the third person narrator jumps consciousnesses between characters, and sort of, I think the essence of that is the blending and the mixing, where sometimes you don't know whose point of view you're getting. So we just look at passages where that happens, like, all right, where did the switch occur? Why? And it's a great conversation because we talk about, like, why are we getting these two characters' points of view, and how are they different in personality, and their identities, how they having a conflict for some reason or another. In Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey's case, you can look at something where they're maybe not understanding each other, not relating to each other, or there's moments where they completely are on the same page and are connected, and you're sort of looking at that, again, that sort of spiritual connection that's shared between characters. So that's what we look at first, just so, any passage that they look at in the book, then they can, like, okay, now we're in Lily's point of view, now we're in Mrs. Ramsey's point of view, and so they can identify, like, who's speaking, no matter what page we're on. So it's kind of something that just sets up our discussion of the whole book. So sometimes good to start with a stylistic thing. Then the next question is next question. The next topic is questions. Those are philosophical questions. What is the meaning of life? Who am I? These sorts of things that the characters are asking themselves. Time. So the next topic is time. So by time, I mean, like, the past, the present, the future. We're thinking about how consciousness sort of, has something to do with the passing of time. The next topic is love and immersion, which is great to do. And because all different kinds of love, like between friends, between Lily and Mrs. Ramsey, perhaps Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey, all these different characters. And then the last topic is painting. So I always, before I sit down for a unit, I always think about, like, all right, what's the order of these topics going to be? Like I said, I usually start with foundational topics that lay the groundwork for the essential questions of the unit. These topics will often explore the external world of the protagonist, right? I start sort of on the outside. I described this in another podcast and blog called Hourglass Unit Planning. So the hourglass is, like, you start with the world of the character, everything outside of them, like the topic that the concerns about status and class and wealth and maybe race, gender, those sorts of things, the culture of the place. And then you sort of move inward. So you're like, all right, this is where the character lives, but what topics have to do with their psychology, their motivations, their mental processes? And I end with positive and uplifting topics. So that's how I end the unit, like in this case, painting. And so get to that in a second, but, things like love, hope, imagination, joy, some topic like that. That sort of brings all of the ideas of the novel together. Into the Lighthouse, I kind of mentioned how I start with the talk about narrative voice. That's important, I think, depending on the novel that you're covering. The point of To the Lighthouse is to figure out how to spiritually connect to the feelings and thoughts of another person using art and imagination. So that's something we sort of talk about that a little bit in that topic. Then we'll talk about the philosophical questions the book raises, and we end with the symbolism of Lily's painting because it brings all these ideas of the novel together, like I said, and leaves the hope that art could solve the problems of the First World War and answer questions relating to time, space, identity, and meaning. So that's another sort of advantage of going topic by topic, is that you're sort of leading them. It's like backward design to some extent, right, where you're leading them to this end point. But unlike backward design, where you have some end goal in mind, for me, it's just, hey, we're ending with this topic. I'm going to ask you a question. What do you think? So I'm not really, I don't care where we end up, really. There's just different things that I want to talk about, topics I want to talk about, questions I want them to think about answering. But I don't have the end in mind, but I do have, some idea of, like, I want to end on with a conversation that they can walk away, where they can walk away with the book and do something with the book. And they, in this case, they're thinking about art, but they're also thinking about being creative in general. And that means athletes and scientists and people who are creating products, right? And so Lily is just, she's creating a painting, but everybody's creating something. And they and people, you know, want to have a personality, not identity. And that's what she's sort of thinking about. So that's why we end there. So as far as the activities part of this, whole novel activities, I have guided notes. So they always, I can kind of say, okay, work with a partner. You can work on this by yourself. I usually just give them options. If you want to work in a group, work in a group. You know, if you want to work with a partner, if you want to work by yourself, some kids really, especially this year, like doing that because they spent last year behind a screen or whatever. But then I always ask them to present their findings verbally. So there's some accountability there where they kind of talk about what they reviewed with their group or independently. Sometimes I'll give two people three or four passages. If it's a larger group, I can give them a bunch of passages. If it's one person, I can just give them one passage. Like, okay, you're just going to do this one passage. I can say, hey, here's these 10 passages. Why don't you pick the best four or five? And then as far as what they do, there's just, I can, every day I walk in, I just kind of think of different things. They can create a one pager with all the passages, right? Because you have a single topic. So you can create a one pager that is on a topic, you know, where they're starting with one idea and then getting to other ideas. And that's how body paragraph works, right? So it's sort of practice for that. They can create a poster with four or five people. I have these really large posters, so they can just gather all their ideas and all their interpretation of all these different quotes. They can write the quotes on the poster. They can write their interpretation of the quotes. They can have images. A mind map is really fun. Sketch notes really fun. It doesn't matter. I mean, there's just so many different opportunities. You know, of course, there's Canva or Google Drawing. So multiple people can work on this online document to create a visual. Those are really fun. Sometimes I make those really big sizes. So you can get like 20 different, you know, ideas or topics onto one sort of graphic organizer. That's the original term for all these things that we're describing. When I plan, I you know, for this reason, this is what makes this easy, is I try to differentiate so I can switch up whatever activities. I have a kind of long list of different activities that I can do with each topic. And then, of course, I can always prioritize, you know, doing two things, you know, doing close readings with any one of the passages related to that topic. But also just reading the passages out loud. I really make that a central part of my class because I think it's so easy to understand the emotions of a passage if you hear the emotions, if you hear the words, and those emotions cause me or somebody in the class to have the emotion as they read it. That's fluency, right? That's what we call fluency, where you can read it knowing the meaning and the emotion, because that's what the meaning is, right, is the emotion behind the words. We have to have students that, if we're going to enjoy reading, they really need to know how to read passionately and really understand how to articulate and vocalize, I guess, really is a better word, the feelings in the passage. And you want to pay homage to those emotions that are behind the words that you're reading. So that's all really important too. So that lends itself to this too. I have 10 different passages related to a topic. We can just read those passages out loud, or we don't have to read those passages out loud. We can just talk about them. But the option is always there. Another example is Beloved by Toni Morrison. This is interesting because I just taught this for the first time last year, but I'm using this as an example because I have so many topics. It's such a great, the more topics that you can teach in a novel, that shows its greatness. Right? That's what makes it literature, is that there's a lot of different ideas and there's a lot of different passages related to those ideas. So there's a lot of different points of intersection between the passages and different moments that you can relate. Or you're saying, okay, this passage, you know, and she does, she's the master of that, where there's a couple of different ideas rolling around a single passage. One passage doesn't just say one thing. But there's so many that what I do, instead of just covering a couple like I do with Virginia Woolf, I try to cover all of them, but I'll assign each group one topic, and that one topic might have 20 quotes, and I'll say, all right, pick, you know, I know there's 20 here, so it's going to take a while. It's going to take a couple days. You work in groups and kind of share your ideas. Where's the quote on this page? Usually, you know, point them in the direction of where the passage is in the handouts. But, you know, you can also pick like four, five, just like you would for a body paragraph. You pick out the most important quotes, and those are the ones that they're going to present to the class. So they're responsible for taking notes on everything, but only responsible for presenting on a couple. So that allows us to go through the topics quicker, and cover and get more coverage and more topics and give them more things to write about when they sit down. But, you know, it's interesting. With Hamlet, I only cover two topics, really. For me, the book is about, the play is about acting in madness. And that's the kind of heart and soul. Now, it's also about family and revenge and different things. But it all really does revolve around those two topics. So, you know, it's two different approaches. You can, cover 20 topics in one novel, or you can cover, as little as two or three. If enough ideas come out of those single topics. The other advantage of giving group work like this, last year I had each group find an article, essay, historical event, video, song, poem, whatever, that connects to their topic and to some of the passages that they read. So that's always valuable too. Find a photograph from history, something like that, to help them sort of teach or talk about the topic and talk about the relevance of the topic. So then nobody can say I'm doing critical race theory because my kids are finding the answers to the world that they live in on their own, and just sharing back what they discovered. So that's always a fun and valuable thing to do, is just having them research. So in a way too, when you do it topic by topic, it's just like an essay, right? The group or me has to introduce the topic, answer a question, and then also draw a conclusion. So there's got to be somewhere that you go with it by the end. Now, here's just an example, because it's like kind of hard to imagine with all, maybe you're imagining different topics in the books you teach, but the topics for Beloved are The House is the first one. I'm just going to list them. Ghosts and the Dead, Memory, Motherhood, Intimacy, Race, Slavery, Silencing, Luxury, Vegetation, Religion, and Love. So that's a lot, right? Like, that would take me forever to get through all those topics. So that's kind of why I approach it the way I do. The point of Beloved is to experience the extreme mental effort it takes to uncover the truth behind history or a headline. For that reason, Beloved has a complicated timeline of events, and it's more appropriate to make sense of it after reading the novel. I kind of talked about this at the beginning. Before my students start to read Beloved or any novel that might be difficult to follow, I usually give them a brief outline, bare bones outline of each section, so that they don't feel lost, confused, and then give up. During the 5 or 6 weeks they get to read independently, I will check in from time to time to answer their questions about the plot or the characters before I collect their notes. Beloved explores similar topics that appear into The Lighthouse: place, intimacy, time, consciousness, identity, grief, love. In some ways, Morrison's novel builds on the ideas in Wolfe's novel. Covering topics allows for kind of, call it a beautiful entanglement, where one thing happens in a story and it becomes entwined with something somewhere else. If you want to know more about this approach, and I think listening is helpful, but really my online course, why I created the online course, is because you can listen to my explanation, but you can also see my handouts and student work where they're completing it. I can kind of visualize. And also, the huge advantage of taking the online course is that you can download all my materials. That's something you can do early on, is just download the zip file, but you can also download all the files in each of the sections that I cover in the course. And so then you can actually just see it for yourself, see the actual questions that I create based on the topics. So I just go into more in depth just because there's a lot of visuals there to explain everything that I'm talking about now. So that's just one section of my course. I have three different sort of major sections, and each section, I call it easy, exciting, and excellent teaching. So each of those three, easy, is kind of designed for early sort of teachers, just getting their feet wet and trying to figure out how to handle all this stuff, classroom management, that sort of thing. But all things related to begin, the first couple of years of teaching. Exciting teaching is for differentiation, note-taking, some of the things I'm describing here. And then excellent teaching is more for, your veteran teachers that might be teaching advanced classes, that sort of thing, where you're getting into some of the heavier, more controversial topics that come up with teaching literature and technologies too. I think I cover the video essay and podcasting. I think that's in the last course, Excellent Teaching. So in each of those, I have their screencasts, so you'll be able to see the handouts and different things that I use in class, and then also download all those handouts after each section. You'll also get to see other teachers who've taken my course. I ask questions related to each topic, and so each teacher will sort of respond to my questions, and you can read their responses and get ideas for things that you can teach. You know, I cover short stories, I cover poetry. You can download my poetry unit, and so you can kind of look at what other teachers are doing around the country just by reading their responses to some of the questions in the course. So that's just a little bit. And you get, now I've organized it. I finally tried to make sense of all the things I did. I just decided to put it all together, and you can get all three different sections that I just described in one course now for I think a pretty fair price. So if you're interested in doing that, you can go to theteachersworkshop.com and check out the courses. If you like listening, please leave me a review online. It really helps me find new listeners and get found on the different apps out there. So thank you very much for listening.